Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Hello and welcome to the Aware Show. I am Lisa Carr, and it's a true privilege to be here today. Thank you for joining me. If you would like to check out our shows on YouTube, we've done a video version of the Aware Show. We've been broadcasting for 18 years on audio, on radio, and we just wanted to put it up so that you guys could see it on video now. So lots of great guests, great tools, tips, techniques. It's all there on YouTube. Please subscribe to the channel. And therefore, you can get the new shows every time that they're uploaded. But also, by subscribing, you are really showing YouTube that conscious media is in demand. It is more so, so you're subscribing to a movement to get our voices heard. So thank you so much for doing that. And you just go to YouTube and you search the Aware Show channel, and you'll find it there. So one of the things that I love about what I do, one of my biggest passions is talking about the brain. As you know, I had a brain injury, I don't know, 18 years ago, which is why I started this radio show. And my daily practice is how I keep my brain working at its top level, at its peak performance. If I didn't have a daily practice, if sometimes I slip off of that daily practice, I start flipping my words and dropping letters off the ends of words. And I mean, things that I, you know, that are new every time that I don't understand. But anyone who's ever experienced a brain injury knows it's not a one thing fixes all situation. So it's become my passion to learn how to operate and how my brain operates. I just love the human brain. And so apparently do the people that I'm interviewing today. They wrote a book, Frederica Fabritius wrote a book called The Leading Brain, along with her partner Hans Hagemann. And Frederica is the head of Neuroleadership Practice Group and a neuropsychologist. She has extensive expertise working with top executives at multinational corporations. And so she uses her love of the brain and her background in science and knowledge of the brain to help CEOs and people who are leaders of companies. So welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'd love to know your story. Why did you write a book like this, and why do you work with people who are executives, who are really working at the top level of their game?
You know, I've always asked myself, why do people behave the way they do?
Mm-hmm.
I just love to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I always ask myself, you know, why are some people lazy and others are workaholics?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that some people get along and others hate each other? These kind of questions really moved me, so I became a neuropsychologist and wanted to understand how the brain works, everything about it. I started out at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research, really researching basic human functioning and brain functioning. I just realized that my questions weren't going anywhere, so then I joined management consulting. I've been with McKinsey for a couple of years, and then I finally was able to pull it all together by becoming a coach, an executive coach.
Hmm.
And that's when I combined both of my passion, the passion for neuroscience with my interest in people's lives and business. And to me, it's very important to make a positive impact. I really want to make people's lives better. So I've been going and looking for applications in neuroscience. So I went through all of the literature trying to see things that are really applicable in neuroscience at the moment.
Mm.
And I applied that to all of these top executives. And, you know, I designed programs and coaching sessions and keynotes. And people loved it. Many told me, you know, this was life-changing. Mm. I still have people that I worked with a decade ago and that contact me and say, you know, I'm still doing these exercises. And so they always ask for a book, a book recommendation. Uh-huh. And I know many great books about the brain. I mean, let's not fool ourselves. There are many good books about the brain. But there wasn't a book that pulled all of it together. There are good books about emotions and good books about decision making and good books about relationships. But, you know, this book is a more encompassing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have one topic. It tells you anything you might want to know about the brain that could be relevant to you as a leader.
I love that. I mean, I love the fact that you're in that neuro leadership is a term. That's
yes.
even a term to lead based on how the brain leads. So I want to ask you the most intriguing question for me is, what is the biggest challenge that leaders have and the biggest struggle that leaders have according to their brain?
I would say the biggest struggle leaders have is a lot of pressure. A lot of travel, high demands, constantly. You know, there's a lot of pressure on people, and how do you deal with that pressure? Research has shown that when people are stressed out, their prefrontal cortex doesn't work as well anymore. And the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain that's responsible for performance, for thinking logically, for thinking strategically, for solving problems. And when you're really stressed out, that part of your brain can shrink or shut down and doesn't work properly anymore. So you need to find a way to get out of that negative situation.
Mm. Now, does that happen in moments of high-level stress or just chronic stress?
Chronic stress, because you have to distinguish. I mean, there is the positive stress associated with a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be when you're slightly over-challenged and when you just have new situations that you need to solve, that can have a very positive impact on the brain. It will actually improve your performance. It will put you into flow. But when you have negative people around you, a boss that doesn't appreciate you, or constant overload of working hours, that will have a negative impact.
Interesting. Or if you are certain parts of your job are not your expertise, then, you know, you still have to manage people. Like, say, someone is great at the business, but they're not great at people management, or someone's great at people management, not great at finances. Yeah.
That is a big problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people perform best when their job is in line with their talents and their strengths.
Yes, yes. Have you seen that where it doesn't work before?
Yes, I've seen that where it doesn't work before. When people are promoted, for example, for you know, their expertise on the topic, you know, on the topic that they're working on, and suddenly they have to manage people, and it just doesn't work because they don't know how to do that.
Yes.
And then things are just going downhill.
I can understand that. So that even that person would get overwhelmed when they're working with things that are outside their wheelhouse and so forth. So how do you teach people who are in the leadership position, who are in high-pressure, high-demand situations, to manage that type of stress?
To me, the key is something that I call emotional regulation. You need to know how to manage yourself. You need to know what works for you to reduce that stress.
Okay. I mean, what works for me are vacations, but I can't always take them. You know what I mean? A nice beach would reduce my stress, but there's no way I'm getting to that beach right now.
Well, let me maybe show you some simpler techniques.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I would love to say vacations are a great way, but not even vacations work for everyone, because some people can't even relax on vacations. You
right.
know, they come back and are even more stressed out. But that's a different story.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we can talk about simple things you can do to feel better. I must say that the best way to influence your emotions is by using your body. Because when people are stressed out and feel badly, usually what they do is they use a cognitive approach. So they use their prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain for rational thinking, to control the limbic system for emotional processing. And that doesn't work. If you, for example, have a coworker you don't like and you're constantly stressed by your boss, for example, it doesn't help to sit in a meeting and think, you know, I pretend to be fine, I will suppress my negative emotions, because you spend all your energy on that suppression.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a problem and you don't acknowledge it and you don't solve it, it's taking a constant toll on your brain. It depletes your resources, this inhibition process. So you need to find a different strategy.
Are you saying to confront the problem, or do you have another strategy to find emotional regulation in stressful situations?
First of all, I think it's always best if you can change the situation. So if you can take charge and get rid of that bad boss, I mean, that's the best thing of all. But we are not always so lucky, you know. So I would like to give some solutions for when you can't solve the situation.
Okay.
If you can change the situation, I would always prioritize this. But if you can change the situation, then you can use your body to influence your emotions. And let me show you how that works. For example, there's one technique that's called power posing.
Okay.
What you do is you can all on the radio do it right now. Get yourself into a confident and comfortable position. So you can take any body position that makes you feel powerful. You can stand up straight. You can put a smile on your face. You can, you know, whatever makes you feel powerful from inside out. You will instantly get a 20% reduction in cortisol. Cortisol is the negative stress hormone. And you will get a 40% increase in testosterone. And testosterone makes you feel confident and powerful. And that is an instant stress relief.
Interesting. And when you sit in a power position, like in your chair straight backed with your feet on the floor, that's a power position?
Yes, whatever makes you feel good. You know, unfortunately we can't see each other right now, but you know.
Well, what if it's laying down? Is that a power position?
Well, maybe if you put your arms behind your back, anything that makes you feel, imagine you're the boss, right?
Okay,
imagine
that wouldn't be
I'm
laying
the boss,
down then.
I'm in charge, I'm in full charge here. So the opposite of, you know, slouching body position where you feel like a victim and somebody who can't influence things. I'm just talking about taking some kind of posture that helps you feel powerful.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the prefrontal cortex is the boss of the brain. Is that right?
Yes and no. We'd like to think that because the prefrontal cortex is the seat of what I call the executive function. For example, the decision to delay gratification, to wait for a reward, to inhibit other feelings. But the prefrontal cortex is very weak. From an evolutionary perspective, that's a part of the brain that we haven't had for so long time. So it's very... it's not always working properly.
And that makes sense. That makes sense because it takes a certain amount of discipline to do things like delay gratification, what you were talking about earlier, put off rewards, things like that.
And it depletes your resources. Let's say you go and inhibit a lot at work, cognitive inhibition. You have to suppress a lot of your emotions or you have to deal with situations you don't like. At the end of the day, you're going to be exhausted. And then you go home and yell at your partner or something like that. We can't control ourselves all day long. It's a ability you can pull it off for an hour or two, but then at some point you're going to break down. So you need to work smarter with your brain. Instead of inhibiting and suppressing, it's easier to actually, for example, acknowledge your emotions. There's another technique that is called affective labeling. And what you do is, let's say you are very sad, okay, and for whatever reason, rather than trying to suppress that sadness and telling yourself, I'm happy, that is a strategy that doesn't work. But if you tell yourself, I am sad, and say that either out loudly or to yourself, it will instantly reduce the activity of the amygdala. And the amygdala is the part of the brain for negative feelings. And it will improve the functioning of your prefrontal cortex, which is for rational thinking. So when you acknowledge your feelings and put a word on it, a label, it actually makes your brain work better.
Do you find people that speak their mind right away and get it over with have less stress than those that hold it in?
Absolutely.
To be politically correct?
Yes. Yes, and they are often also happier. You know, there's research that people who tend to suppress a lot have heart problems more often.
That's so interesting. So speaking your mind is less stressful.
It is, because you don't do that negative cognitive inhibition.
Fascinating. Okay. So in understanding our brain, that we have a CEO in our brain that has the same strengths and weaknesses as a CEO in your office, then you can learn how to work in a little bit more cooperative way with it and allow it time to decompress, and that gives you time to basically to heal. What do you feel about naps or brain breaks in the middle of the day?
Love them. And you know what? I just had a nap prior to our call. I do it every day. I think it's so important to take naps because they instantly restore your brain. Naps are a booster, a brain booster.
I have done that before where I feel so much more energized after a nap. All right. What are other things that we can do in high stress situations in order to center our brains?
I would say exercise, exercise, exercise. And I'm talking about physical exercise here. Physical exercise is the best thing we can do for our brains. When we exercise, a substance is released in the brain that is called the brain-derived neurotrophic growth factor. And it actually helps the growth of new neurons. And it also instantly reduces stress level, and it makes us feel good. It, you know, there's research that shows that when we exercise, it's just as powerful as an antidepressant.
Ah, that's so interesting. I believe it. I can feel that. Sometimes I'll go into workout feeling completely exhausted, and in 20 minutes or maybe even 10 minutes into the workout, I feel more awake than I ever was. And more solution-oriented as well.
Exactly. There's nothing better for our brain than exercise. It has also been shown that you don't get dementia as easily if you exercise. People who are physically active will stay smarter, not more intelligent, but, you know, more alert even when they get older.
Can make quicker decisions, exactly. What do you feel about personality testing and you know, where there's the personality profiling that really kind of segments you or pigeonholes you into a specific profile?
I am very fond of the research of Dr. Helen Fisher. She has developed a personality instrument that is based on science, because very often many of the tests out there, they make claims, you know, to put you into different categories based on your preferences, but they're not accurate. She has developed an instrument by putting people into the brain scanner and really looking at what their brains are, you know.
Like spec scans?
Like fMRI.
Oh, interesting.
So she has really identified, and that has been published in very high-level, you know, very valid scientific papers. And I can give you an idea of her research.
That would be great. So this is
You know, there are some people who love to look for new challenges. You will constantly see them traveling around the world, and whenever you meet them, they have done something new and exciting. These people are called sensation seekers. They are constantly looking for the new next thing, right? They're very curious, energetic, always look for challenges, and that has to do with our dopamine system, with our neurochemistry. The dopamine system in our brain is about how active or how much dopamine is released in the brain. And dopamine is a neurotransmitter that is released when we're having fun, when we experience novelty, when we seek out challenges. In those situations, dopamine is released. And some people have a more active dopamine system than others, and there's a genetic basis to it. Whereas for some people, another substance in the brain is more relevant, serotonin. And serotonin makes you, is, for example, relevant for having a stable mood. So people with a very active serotonin system, they're going to be very reliable, they enjoy structure, they enjoy routine. None of these two approaches is better than the other. You know, it's just a different way of leading your life.
So how do you raise levels of serotonin and or dopamine without pharmaceuticals?
Exercise, I have to say. I mean, it might be very boring, but the most effective way to balance out your neurotransmitters is exercise, physical exercise.
Is it any specific type of exercise where it's weight-related or that releases certain neurotransmitters or cardio?
There's research both for cardio and strength exercises. Both of them have a positive impact.
What about yoga?
Yoga also has a positive impact. Yoga is also similar to mindfulness training. You know, some of the people listening might have heard about mindfulness. Mindfulness is also a very powerful way of influencing your brain, but it is a more cognitive technique. It's about staying fully present in the here and now. And people who are able to be more focused in the present, they also have a much better functioning brain.
Would you say to exercise first and then go into a mindfulness, or yoga would work because it has exercise within it?
It has both of it. So I think yoga is a good mix of physical exercise and mindfulness. You train both at the same time.
Great. Okay, so let's talk about the importance of sleep. Does sleep allow you, I mean, you're obviously not releasing dopamine and serotonin while you're sleeping, but does it help you with more production when you wake up?
It does. And what it also does is during sleep, we know that sleep has a positive impact on memory. So during sleep, memory is stored or transferred from short-term memory to long-term memory. It has been shown that when you sleep, you improve your memory. And what it also does is that it removes negative stress hormones associated with your memory. And that is one of the reasons why over time, when we look back at the past, it all looks more positively. You know how you look back at a negative experience and then you say, oh, it's
best
not all
that ever
bad.
Happened. Yes, exactly. Interesting. So it makes a positive impact on memory. And do you know how much sleep?
Well, I think if you wake up and you're well rested, then you had enough. This might seem like a fuzzy answer, but you know, there is an individual difference on how much sleep people need. Some people need 9 hours; others are happy with 7. On average, it's 8 hours.
I was wondering if you could share anything that you might know about sleeping, where certain chemicals make you stay asleep and have a hard time waking up. Do you know what that is from?
Well, what you can say is that on sleep, melatonin system is very important. Also your serotonin system. It's never one substance in isolation. They all work together. I think most people have rather the problem of waking up too early. When I look at most executives, some of them wake up very early in the morning and are not well rested. And that is because their cortisol levels are too high. And because in the morning, cortisol is released to make us wake up. Cortisol is a stress hormone. And when you're really stressed out in your life, cortisol will disrupt sleep. I hardly ever have people that tell me that they sleep too much. I hear all the time of people who have the problem that they don't sleep enough or are not well rested after sleeping or they can't fall asleep. That has to do with your cortisol levels.
Yes, that makes sense. That makes perfect sense. So there's no such thing as oversleeping. I mean, I mean, too much sleep.
I don't see it in practice. Mm-hmm. There might be, but I always see these people who are not getting enough sleep.
Of course.
I think that is a problem that really impacts society.
So you have maybe a whole corporation of people who maybe 80% of them are sleep deprived. I mean, in your practice, what do you think?
Many of them, and the problem is that it's almost like a medal of honor. People like to brag about the fact that they need some little sleep. So you have these urban myths. People compete with each other on how much time they spend awake, almost. And the ironic thing is that you're not being your most productive self if you don't sleep. It inhibits learning if you don't sleep enough. It inhibits, you know, it deteriorates performance if you don't sleep enough. Mm-hmm. It has a very negative impact on mood, on performance, on learning if you don't sleep enough.
So you've got corporations out there who have sleep-deprived people that hold their feelings inside and don't speak their truth, and when they are less,
yes,
they don't have any time to exercise, so they have less dopamine and less serotonin. No wonder the work environment gets so toxic. Let's talk about that. Meetings. When you have a meeting and it tends to not be productive or distracting or there's incomplete things, what are some of the things that you recommend based on brain performance that help make a meeting worthwhile?
I think it's very important to distinguish who's in that meeting. That's the first choice. I think a meeting should be an assembly of experts. Many companies I see today are exaggerating. They think everybody should be in the meeting, and that's a way of giving recognition to people. Mm. And I understand people want to be involved, but that's not always the best possible choice for that meeting because you spend all your day in meetings where in reality mm-hmm. you could be working on other problems during that time. So I recommend to really just, you know, let the experts do the meeting. And if you really have a diverse team of experts, it will be that, you know, you and I will be in one meeting and then other colleagues are going to be other meetings. Everybody is going to be involved, but not everybody in all meetings.
Mm.
It will be, I don't know, am I expressing myself? But I just think from a brain perspective, and this is why I suggest that, it has been shown that experts make decisions in a different way than non-experts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Experts make better decisions than non-experts. So you should really try to identify who's the expert for that specific topic and then let that person decide about that specific topic.
What about when a meeting happens and everybody puts their smartphone on the table?
Well, that is a problem because people are never fully there.
Yeah.
You know, they are looking at their smartphone, and we know that multitasking is very detrimental to performance.
Let's talk about that. Facebook and all sorts of different social media platforms are pretty much catalysts for multitasking.
Yes, and we know that in order to perform well, we need to be fully focused. All the research on flow and peak performance shows that if people are not fully focused, they can't perform well. Imagine Lang Lang, the, you know, piano player.
Mm.
He performs in front of thousands of people, and then he's not checking his smartphone.
Can you
in between,
imagine?
You know?
No, right.
You cannot get into peak performance
right.
when you multitask. It's a sad truth. It's impossible.
It is impossible. What does multitasking do to the brain?
It actually drops your IQ. It also makes people very, very unhappy. Research has shown that when people are not able to be fully present, they are more depressed and miserable. Because when you have that flow experience of being fully present in the moment and really not thinking about yesterday, not thinking about tomorrow, and really staying in the present, it makes you much happier and more productive. Research has shown that people who are in a flow state are 5 times more productive than they are otherwise.
Hmm. So really just focusing at the task at hand. And what about those things that do gnaw on you, like phone calls and emails and things that are disrupting? Do you suggest turning them off or not having your phone when you're in a committed conversation? Or
There's one thing that I like to call a meeting of one, and I'm a big fan of that. What is a meeting of one? You know how people always assume that if you are in a conversation or if you are in a meeting, you're not to be disturbed, and they respect that. But when you're sitting alone in your office, and you might even have your door open, everybody thinks they can come in and have a chat and disturb you. And that is also, I mean, I like for people to communicate and be friends at work. There's nothing wrong with that. But in some corporations, people are constantly disturbed by their coworkers. You have these open office spaces. You can never think straight because there's always somebody chatting into your ear. So what I suggest is that you, on a regular basis, block your calendar and you write a meeting of one. You know, I'm meeting myself. Yeah. I sit down and I focus and I concentrate and I work on something that's relevant to me without a phone call, without email, without people coming in and disturbing me.
Interesting. So you have a meeting with yourself and you schedule it.
Yes.
But what if you're in a cubicle situation or open space and you can't, what do you put a caution tape across your cubicle and said, in a meeting with myself?
It's difficult. I'm not a big fan of these open office solutions. What I've seen people do, and we know that about half of the population are introverts. These open office spaces are often designed by extroverts, by people who love to surround themselves all day long by people and who get energized by it. And it's detrimental for the performance of introverts, people who prefer to actually spend some time alone every day in order to get more energized. And what I see people do is that they build little, it's almost they put their jackets so that nobody can see them. They try to almost build like a little cage around them. They put in earphones and listen to music while working. People try to create a little bit of privacy. And what I know from brain research is that when there's constantly people around us, that can also set off a threat response, and then we're constantly stressed.
Interesting. Now, what about when you get home from the work environment and there's more multitasking there, especially if you're a parent and you've got, you know, dinner to make, kids needing to help with homework or bedtime or whatever it is, that the nature of a home environment is a multitasking environment, especially if you're a mother.
Yes and no. I'm a mother of four, so I know what you're referring to. Trust me, it's not that I'm... But this is not multitasking. The interesting thing is very often we think that certain things are multitasking, and they are not. Let me explain. Multitasking is defined as when you do two things at once that involve your prefrontal cortex. What do I mean by that? The prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain that does the rational thinking. So imagine that while the two of us talk, you are checking your emails at the same time and writing an email to a colleague. It's impossible to do it. You can't write an email and have an intelligent conversation.
No.
Because both of them involve your prefrontal cortex. Now let's look at the thing that women are doing at work, at home. Very often it involves some activities that are automized. So, for example, if you cook a lot, and very often if you're always the one preparing dinner, you can almost do that without involving your prefrontal cortex. You're cooking dinner or ironing that shirt with your basal ganglia. And the basal ganglia are the part of your brain that
get
involved when you have automatized behavior. Let me give you an example. When you learn how to drive a car, in the beginning, you drive that car with your prefrontal cortex. You have to focus. You have to think, okay, how do I push the brake? How do I push the gas? How do I stop the car? Oh, I need to turn. You know, at the moment, at the beginning, when you learn how to operate a car, it involves all of the resources of your prefrontal cortex. You really have to focus, and you're not able to talk to somebody while you drive the car. You're not able to do other things. Later on, when people have driven miles and miles and miles in cars for years, they can almost do other things I'm not suggesting that you should do that, but I'm just saying you get the feeling that while you drive the car, you can talk and have a conversation because you're not driving the car with your prefrontal cortex anymore. And this is what happens at a home. People think that many women are multitasking when in reality they do one activity with their prefrontal cortex, such as talking to the husband or the kids, while the other activities they're carrying on at the same time, they are doing them with their basal ganglia.
My basal ganglia burns things. But other than it's very good at that. Tell me, why do you think that they made driving and cell phone use illegal to do at the same time?
It has been shown that you cannot operate a car completely from your basal ganglia. It does involve a certain amount of focused attention from your brain. People get the impression that they can fully drive on autopilot, but it's not true.
Ah, so it's definitely, you need probably your prefrontal cortex to make executive decisions and quick decisions when you're driving.
Exactly.
Yet it could be fairly hypnotic, especially in LA traffic, which is the number one worst traffic in the world. That is a new report that just came out. It's tough. Have you heard of split tasking?
No. What is that?
When you do two different things at the same time that involve the prefrontal cortex.
And then what usually happens is that you have a sequential approach. You switch between tasks quickly. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, yes. So I don't do this on radio shows, but I never check my phone on radio shows, but I know some hosts that do that, that during a radio show they'll be emailing the producer and they'll be doing things that, well, actually I do sometimes on a radio show I'll have the engineer in my ear saying we've got to go to break or something like that. So that's split tasking. I can still hear what you're saying, but yet I can also hear the engineer saying 3, 2, 1 or 5 minutes or 1 minute or whatever. There is such a thing, yes?
Yes, and you know what? Many people think they are multitasking, but in reality, as you say, they're switching between tasks.
Switching.
But these switches, they take a toll on you. I mean, I think it is relevant for you. You have to listen to your producer. You cannot just like say, whoa, you know,
that's
we talk now, leave
thing.
Me alone.
Yeah,
so
right.
It is relevant to your work, and I'm not suggesting you shouldn't do that. But I'm just saying when you switch between tasks that do involve your prefrontal cortex, you always need a moment to get back. Research has shown that it takes you up to 20 minutes to get back on track after a disruption.
Wow. Wow. Is there any way to shorten that if you do an intentional meditation or a break, or do you really just have to leave the 20 minutes?
Some people are very good at focusing. If you look at sports or if you look at people in jobs such as artists who perform in front of people, they can turn it on. They can get into the zone almost, like in the second.
Mm-hmm.
They get on stage, and the moment they get on stage, they get into flow. But that is because these people are very skilled at what they're doing, so it's easier to do that when you have a very high skill level, and they also are constantly challenged.
Lots of practice.
So these people do not get into flow when they are practicing. They only get into flow when it's a real thing, because from a brain chemistry perspective, you do need the challenge in order to be fully productive. And I'm talking about something that I call being slightly over-challenged.
Mm.
We do perform best when we're slightly over-challenged, when it's a real deal. It does make a difference whether you play piano just for practicing, or whether you have 100 people sitting in front of you and expecting you to make a spectacular performance.
Interesting. So let's actually, there's so many things. I'm glad we have time here. I have lots of questions. Okay. So when you're focused on something like, say, work, and you have a job to perform, but yet there's something that's kind of sucking up your mental bandwidth that's running in the background, like caring for an aging parent, or there's a sick child at home, or you're going through a divorce, or something that's that's unsolvable in the moment. It does kind of suck up mental bandwidth trying to save a business, mm-hmm. something like that. How do you focus and get tasks done when probably, you know, 50% of your mental bandwidth is being sucked up by trying to figure out something that's not solvable in the moment?
I so understand what you mean. What I think the most helpful advice for people in a situation like this is take charge. Research has shown that when we are under long-term stress or when a lot of demand is on us, the most important thing about whether you go into burnout or not, you know, whether you go into depression as a result or not, is whether you feel that you're in control of the situation or not.
Mm.
And I'm not talking that you really have to be in control of the situation. I'm just talking about whether you feel in control. So I always, when I work with coaches and people who seek my advice on situations like this, I always try to install a situation where you take charge. Try to create a situation and to use whatever resources you have available to make it better for you. Take an active
action.
Approach to things.
That's
people
true.
Suffer when they feel that they're being a victim.
Helpless.
And can't change anything. That is the worst thing for people.
True, absolutely. If you're, as long as you're staying in action about something, you might not resolve it right away, but you're not in that helpless victim state, which is disempowering.
Exactly.
I see. Great. Okay, so you mentioned something called the imposter syndrome. I think this is really important to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
This means that some very high-performing individuals will still think deep inside that they're being a fraud. So they say, you know, I didn't get into this position because I'm a talented, smart individual. I got into this position out of pure luck, and they are afraid to be found out.
Mm.
There's also the, you know, there's the expression of the insecure overachiever. People that are very successful in life, but they're always afraid that one day there will not be that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what is a way for people to be at peace with what they do and be authentic about it? True. I mean, really, I'm not talking about fake it till you make it here,
mm-hmm.
but how do you bridge the gap?
I think you said something very important. It doesn't help to fake it. Let me first show you what doesn't work because it's so popular, and then I show you what does work. What doesn't work is to tell yourself something you don't believe in. You know, there are so many self-help books out there that claim that you should use positive affirmations, that you should write on your bathroom mirror, I'm a beautiful, wonderful person, I love myself. It has been shown that these approaches do not work. Even worse, they make it worse.
Why?
Because if you don't really believe that, deep down inside, you won't trick your brain into believing that. You create something that is called cognitive dissonance.
Hmm.
It does work if you really, truly love yourself and think you are valuable and feel like a smart person. Then it makes you feel better because then your brain knows you're talking about something that is true, and then it enhances that. But most people who use these techniques, deep down inside, they feel miserable about themselves.
So if
and
I...
then, let's say, I think I'm ugly, and then I put a post-it on my bathroom mirror saying I'm beautiful, and then my brain picks up that dissonance and makes me feel even more miserable. Research has shown that you cannot fight ingrained habits and ingrained beliefs in our brain. The things we really believe in, they cannot be inhibited so quickly. We talked about cognitive inhibition earlier today, and you cannot trick your brain into believing something you don't. So,
interesting.
I mean, it's a big problem because I see all
these
books out there and desperate people with a lot of problem are buying them. And
mm-hmm.
they are, unfortunately, very often these approaches make it worse. So this is why I want to make a warning about this technique because I know many people are using it and it can work, but only if you already think you're wonderful. And then you don't need these techniques and then you don't buy these books.
I had a radio show that really turned that around for me that I had a caller call in, and she says, you know, she spoke the law of attraction speak very, very well, and she was seemed like a very smart lady, but she said, I have gone through my entire savings. I quit my job because I wanted to have freedom, and I'm now burning through my 401k, and I believe that I'm going to make it work, and I'm visualizing that I'm going to make it work. And I mean, she's doing all the affirmations, but she was almost about to lose her house. I mean, her apartment that she'd moved into, because she'd already lost her house. And I realized, oh my God, the level of responsibility that we have when we say things like that needs to come with an owner's manual. But my question for you is, what do you do? I mean, I can have a sticky that says I'm a supermodel. I don't believe that. I don't look like a supermodel. Do I put a sticky up there and says I eat chocolate cake? Because that's what I do.
I do have a solution, and not just one. There's several things you can do. One thing that really does work, and I like to always look at the research and look at what really makes people happier, is gratitude therapy. Mm-hmm. And what is gratitude therapy? It is, for example, writing down 5 things every morning or evening or whenever you have time that you are grateful for on that specific day. It can be something like, I was grateful today that my coworker helped me. I was grateful today that I had an hour of free time to exercise. I was grateful today for whatever positive thing happened to me today or something good I did today. And it has been shown that when people engage in gratitude, their mood and how they feel about themselves really improve.
That is great. So the statistics around gratitude therapy.
Very much so.
Rather than affirmations. Well, that's fascinating. So back to the imposter syndrome. If you don't feel that this comes up in public speaking a lot. So if you're going to give a presentation at your work or anything related to that, that self-doubt comes up with, oh my God, who I don't know what I'm talking about. Yet you go up there and you nail it because you did. So you're not actually an imposter after all. How do you realize that before you put yourself through all of that torture of thinking that you don't know what you're doing?
I think the important thing is something that is called self-efficacy. There's a lot of research that shows that successful people in life and people who feel good about themselves, they use something that is called self-efficacy. And that is that you look at your past behavior and you realize what you have accomplished and you celebrate that. So you install in yourself the belief that by taking an active approach and by practicing things and by taking charge of a situation, you can improve and shape your own destiny. For example, children that have learned to play an instrument improve their self-efficacy because you practice and you practice and you practice. The same is true for sports. And you see how you improve. There is a history of continuous improvement, and that strengthens how you feel about yourself because you make that positive experience that by taking an active approach and by taking charge of the situation, you actually do improve.
Interesting. So you basically prove it to yourself.
Yes.
And you need to take note of proving it to yourself and not just forget that or be overly humble about it, but really take note of, hey, I nailed it. I knew what I was talking about and I did it.
Exactly.
Or I got that contract and, you know, good for me or whatever it is. Yeah. There's a concept that you talk about in the book. And by the way, my guest is Frederica Fabridius, and the book is called The Leading Brain. And in the book, you talk about the concept of Kaizen. Can you explain how that, what is Kaizen, and when was it created, and how does it work?
Kaizen is the technique of continuous improvement, of taking very small steps on your path to success. When people try to change and when people set goals, very often they overwhelm themselves by having two extreme goals. So they say, rather than saying, I lose 2 pounds, they say, I will lose 20 pounds, right? Mm. And I'm going to start eating cabbage soup from tomorrow on, and I will never eat chocolate again, and I will exercise every day for 2 hours. And then they never get started. It's overwhelming. These kind of exuberant goals and big changes set off the threat response in our brains. We don't like change. So they never get started. You set your goal and then you say, oh, I start tomorrow, because it seems so overwhelming and impossible. And Kaizen is the opposite approach. You take very small steps, and rather than saying, I exercise every day for 2 hours, you start out by taking a one-minute walk.
Okay. So you have small successes, and you prove to the brain that it's achievable.
Yes, and that's very effective.
Why do people, though, then lose 5 pounds and gain 10 back?
I shouldn't laugh, that's very sad, but that is just so typical. What happens there is that their new behaviors have not become a habit. Let me explain. We are effective to change when we install new habits, when the new behavior becomes part of your daily routine, if you don't have to think about it anymore, if you have to force yourself every time you go to the gym and think about it for 2 hours before you do it, then you're going to drop that behavior very soon. So the key is something that I call making homemade habits.
Yeah, it has to be sustainable, right? So easy.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So fasting and those fad types of diets, not, I mean, I'm talking about fad fasting. There's some fasting that's really, really great. But those types of fad diets, that could be the reason that it's not sustainable in the body, and the brain reverts back to its old behavior times 10.
Yes, and there's a simple technique I'd like to introduce, how you can trick your brain into forming new habits.
Please do,
and
share.
It's by creating an if-then function. Let me give you an example. If you do decide to exercise more frequently, it does not help to say, I will exercise more frequently. That's very vague. And every day after work, you think, oh, no, not today. Today I'm so tired. I'd rather go and eat a hamburger. So you do have to associate a specific moment when you're going to exercise. So rather than saying, I will exercise more frequently, you say, when I get home from work, then I go to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
Or
okay.
When I wake up in the morning, then I work out. You need to associate your new behavior with a specific situation, and that's when people install habits. You need a temporal cue.
That's good for when you're trying to add a new habit. What if you're trying to take away habits like eating chips or willpower?
That is much more difficult. Our brains... habits are very, very, very stable in the brain, because the more often you do something, the more that habit is going to be strengthened in the brain. So every time you engage in a behavior, it strengthens the pathway associated with that behavior in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things you can do. It's more difficult, I must say. What you need to do, though, and it does work, is to identify a substitute behavior. So rather than inhibiting an unwanted behavior, let's say you're somebody who bites their nails, very common problem, right? If you just sit at your desk and say, don't bite your nails, I'm not going to bite my nails, you can hold that up for 5 minutes and then you bite your nails, right? So what you need to do instead is to think, okay, each time I have the impulse of biting my nails, what am I going to do instead?
Water or something like that,
right? It's much more easier to install a new habit than to take away another one. So you need to identify something you can do instead. When that impulse comes that makes you want to bite a nail, you need to have an alternative behavior in place that you're going to engage in instead.
That brings me to the topic of positive thinking. Is it better for you in a difficult situation to say, this is going to be difficult, and to look at it for what it is? Or can you tell your brain, this is going to be easy, this is going to be effortless, this is going to flow? Which one is more effective?
Interesting question. What really has been shown to be helpful is to not envision the result, but the path to the result. So rather than thinking of the outcome of your desired behavior, you think of the steps you have to take to get there.
My daughter's a club goalie, soccer player.
Uh-huh.
And we do a lot of visualization in the goal, but we do it like standing on the grass, feeling the grass and smelling it, and then contacting her gloves, and then her gloves contacting the ball. And we go through these steps, not in the outcome of the win or the lose, but the steps of being in the goal and catching the balls. Does that work?
Yes. And you know what you're, and let me take the example of your daughter. You're not envisioning, and this could also work, but you're not thinking of the celebration afterwards when she did that and how everybody is going to say good job and well done. You're actually envisioning the steps she's taking, the stuff she's doing during the soccer playing, and that is helpful. You need to envision your activity, and it is in line with what I said earlier, that we are successful in life when we take an active approach to things. So if you visualize the things you're going to do, that's always helpful.
Well, I have heard, though, but if you visualize the celebration after the game or after the promotion or something, if you visualize that step, that it helps you get closer to your goal. Is that not true?
It is true, but it's not enough. It is easier, let's say your daughter has been successful in the past, then she can relate to that. She has made that experience before, and her brain believes in that, and she can link back to that. And when we anticipate a positive situation, our brain releases dopamine. Dopamine is released when we anticipate a reward. So in a positive situation, our brain releases dopamine, and that makes us feel great. Dopamine is already released even before, prior to that situation, if we expect positive results. And that is very powerful. So your daughter should keep on doing that. But that alone, let's say you're somebody who has never played soccer. You never had success in playing soccer. You're sitting on your couch, and then you're just imagining how you will be celebrated. That is not going to be enough. You need to visualize both the steps you need to take, and then you can, on top of that, also visualize the good things that are to come, and that gives your brain an extra boost in dopamine, and that is good.
Fascinating. I know we are all ultimately addicted to dopamine.
Addiction. You are right on.
It's very true. Rewards. Well, thank you so much. There's so many more questions I have for you, but people are just going to have to read the book to get the answers. It's called The Leading Brain, Powerful Science-Based Strategies for Achieving Peak Performance. And thank you so much for sticking with me and for the hour here. I know that a lot of the interviews you do are much shorter. So fascinating. We got to do a deep dive into a lot of the issues and what it has to do with our wonderful brains. Thank you so much, Frederica. Appreciate
it. It's been a big pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. All right. And thank you all so much for listening. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.